overflowing with love. I am overflowing with happiness. I am filled with the power to make a change, to create a brand new life.
Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center for Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week. Many blessings to you.
This morning I call on Bert and Speck, beloved companions of David and Trey. I call on Stone Michael Anderson, beloved son of Dave and Denise. I call on Lindsay Roebuck, my best friend and soulmate. I call my mom, my dad, all my friends, family, all my beloved animals that have been a part of my life. I call on each and every being who has participated in any way in this grand adventure we call life. With this calling, I know that they are always present. I know that there's nowhere that they would rather be than by my side. I know that love never dies. Only the body goes anywhere. And I know that this love is as close as my breath. It's the beating of my heart. It's the blessings that come into my life every second of every day. I know that this love protects me and guides me. I know that all I have to do is be open to the clues that their presence is here. So with this knowing in my heart, with this absolute certainty that this love is present, I allow this Sunday celebration to flow, to unfold in its divine right perfection. So, as the Jews say, may your memory be a blessing now and always. And so it is. So it's always a great honor when David takes a Sunday off and invites one of us to speak. And he always tries to give you a topic or give you a talk or kind of guide you along the way. And this time he asked me what I wanted to talk about, and my answer immediately was death. Recently, a young man who was a huge part of my life, my son's life, big part of the music scene here in Huntsville. Stone Anderson made his transition on April the 9th. And it was unexpected. Stone had a really large and beautiful life. And that life included some experimenting, some recreational drug use, some things that may have transacted in some dark alleys. And really, unfortunately, for us, not for Stone, but for us, one night as he was getting ready to go to work, he, I am sure, quite joyfully used a little something-something, and that something stopped his heart. So his friends who were expecting him to come to work recognized at first, well, he was just a little late, and then a little more time went by and they realized that something wasn't wrong, wasn't right. Something was wrong, not right. So Stone's friend Meredith went to his home, their home, they were roommates, and she found him and he was listening to some music and getting ready to go to work. And he just didn't make it. He didn't wake up. His physical body didn't make it. Quite a shock. I can't imagine what it felt like to be Stone's parents when they got that phone call that evening. I only know what it felt like for me when my daughter came in and I had already gone to sleep. I'm an early, early bird. I went to bed at like 7:30 that night. And Allie came in and said, "Mom, Stone is gone." And, you know, my first thought was, well, where did he go? And then the recognition kicked in that she meant he was dead, that Stone had passed away. I called my son, Richard, spoke to him for just a moment. I called Rob, my other son. Couldn't get Rob on the phone. I know he was in a state of shock and grief. I called Dave, his father. Made all these calls within a few minutes of each other. Dave obviously was in shock and grief. I think the minutes, the moments after we discover that someone we love has died, we can only be filled with grief, with shock, with sorrow, with tears. I can't think of a time when I've experienced death that wasn't my initial reaction. You know, you just want to dissolve. You want to cry. You want to scream. You want to just lash out at how this could happen. Where did this happen to Stone? How did this happen to Stone? How did this happen to Lindsay? How did this happen to Tess? How? And why am I here? Why am I stuck with this grief, this pain? How is this horrible thing, this horrible experience happened to me? And then you start talking to people. You start expressing how you feel. You start communicating, whether it's in words or energy, the sharing of a story on Facebook, sharing of pictures, call up another friend. It's kind of an Irish tradition to have people share this grief with you. I'm sure if I were David Leonard, I could call the word to mind now and speak it with a wonderful Irish accent, but I just can't right now. But people come and they wail and they cry with you, and in doing so, they lighten your burden. Then there's a gathering of friends and family. Then there's a wake where we expand this circle. We expand this community out to include more and more people. And we tell stories of our loved one, and we tell funny things that happened and sad things that happened, and we talk about the love. We talk about the joy that they brought to our life. And that grief and that loneliness gets lighter and lighter. Even when we feel like it can't get any better. It can't. It's not possible that I could ever feel joy. I remember when Lindsay died thinking, I'll never be able to smile again. But you know what? You do. And it's because of this human physical connection that we know that we so easily can be a part of and fall into. But over the years of my life, and especially since coming here to CSL, I have learned something about death. When I first came here, my best friend had just passed away. It was in June of 1999 when she died. She and I were two peas in a pod. We were as close as two human beings could be. We shared all of our secrets. We shared our job. We shared our homes. We shared our children. We shared our pets. We did everything together. We went to concerts. We went to the beach. We had a Thursday night movie night where we would just, you know, pile up in bed and watch movies and let the kids and dogs and everyone just pile around us. And we were at the beach on vacation, and it was meant to be a girls' trip. And she invited her boyfriend down for the weekend. And oh, it made me so mad. I was very unhappy about that because I felt like, you know, he was intruding on our time. And so I left. I got my self-righteous butt in my car, and I drove back to Birmingham where my kids were staying. And the next morning I got the call, and it knocked me to my knees, you know. It just knocked me out. She and her boyfriend had been at a bar, and he decided to go sleep in the car while she finished playing pool or whatever they were doing. And she got in the car to drive back to the hotel, and there was a curve in the road, and she missed the curve and went straight into a tree. And this was back in the time. Y'all remember those cars that had automatic shoulder belt? Like, so you couldn't forget to put your shoulder belt on? Yeah. And they also had a lap belt you had to buckle. Well, she didn't buckle the lap belt. So when she hit the tree, her body stopped. Her heart stopped, and she died. It took me about 3 months to get from that experience to get here to CSL. And I remember coming to my first healing circle on Sunday mornings. We used to call them healing circles. Now we call them revealing circles because we know there's really nothing to heal. There's only that which wants to be revealed in ourselves. So we come together and we sit and we share what's going on in our lives. And I remember sharing about Lindsay's death. It was 21 years ago. And I felt a little bit crazy because I felt like Lindsay was sitting in my lap. I felt like she was there with me that day. And I told Reverend David that I could feel her hair in my hands. She loved to sit between my knees, and I would braid her hair. And I do still feel the silk of her hair in my hands when I bring her to mind. But I remember David saying, she's right there. Where would she go? Of course she's right there. Her love will never leave you. She will never leave you. Just because her body has gone doesn't mean she's not with you anymore. And it was a new thought for me. It was a new idea. People in the Jewish faith don't believe in heaven or hell. Even as a young child, I remember the rabbis talking about living a good life. And that's how you create your afterlife. Your memories are what's left of you. They don't believe that you do things here on earth so that you can have a happy afterlife. Or if you're bad here on earth, you're going to hell. They just don't exist in Jewish tradition or Jewish writings. So I came here with a little bit of a different idea about death. My parents told me that you're gone. You just die. There's, you know, you put your body in the ground or you cremate it or whatever, and that's the end. Something never felt right about that to me, but neither did the idea of a place where you go. The idea of our pets leaving us and going to wait somewhere, the Rainbow Bridge, that to me is kind of a heaven and hell story, and I really don't like it. I don't resonate with that. What I know now that I didn't know 20 years ago is that spirit, our soul, was never born. Therefore, it can't die. I really thought that Reverend David made that up. I thought that was a quote that we could attribute to him. But turns out it was the Bhagavad Gita. In the second chapter, they talk about the soul. And they talk about the history of the soul. And basically, there's not a history of the soul. There's no birth story about how the soul came into being. There are many, many stories about how human beings came into being, whether they're factual or not. You know, there's the Bible story about Adam and Eve, the story of evolution, the story of creation, the Big Bang Theory. But these are all talking about how the physical body, how material bodies were created. They're not talking about our soul or our spirit. So where would they go? Where on earth, or where in the universe would they go? It's impossible for a spirit or a soul to be diminished in our thoughts. Certainly in our eyes. You know, I can't see Paul taking me down to feed the cows on the farm in Ruth, Alabama. But I can feel Paul in my heart. And I can feel down into my bones the last call for the firemen at Paul's funeral. And all I have to do is remember that and remember, you know, the chill that even now I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it. But what a precious reminder it is. And sometimes that's all we need is a reminder. that love never dies, that the soul never dies, that we're not alone, even though in our grief, our immediate grief especially, all we feel is loneliness. There's a story of an Irish priest in John O'Donohue's book, The Annum Cara. The Annum Cara is the soul friend, it's literal meaning. I take it as soulmate. The first time I read this book, Sherry Messimer was in my heart the whole entire time. And then I got to the very end and there's a chapter on death, and I realized that Lindsay was also in my heart and in my mind. But the story from this book that I didn't remember, I was telling Glory G, it's so interesting and funny how we think we remember words that we've read a long time ago, and often when we go to do the research, they're not exactly the same words. But so there's an Irish priest, and he goes for a walk with one of his parishioners, and they're out walking in a field, and the parishioner says, "So, Father, tell me, what happens to the dead?" And I don't know what this parishioner was expecting, but in the story, the priest thinks that he's expecting something like, well, you know, the soul lies with the body until the Heavenly Father comes again, and then the soul and the body are reunited, or, you know, whatever the story is that is the story of whatever book is leading us. But what the priest did was he said, well, I'm going to tell you a secret, and you cannot tell anyone else this secret. So I don't know why it was a secret, but obviously it was told again and again, because now I know it, and so it must not be a secret. But the priest said, look at the end of my finger, and he pointed out into the field, and the parishioner could see just like dewdrops all of the souls of all of the dead that he had ever known or had ever been. They were all there in the field just for a moment, and he could see clearly that they were there. Not off someplace in heaven, not off someplace in hell, not off someplace unimaginable, but right there in the field. We just have limited vision. We don't think that we have the ability to see, and maybe we don't. I know when Stone died, all I could think was that he was just outside of my vision, and I still kind of feel that way. It's like I'm limited. I am limited, not Stone. He is no longer limited by anything. He is as free as any of us will ever be. I'm just limited because I can't see where he is and what he's doing. I know he's there. I know in my heart that he's there. So after Stone's death, his father, David, and his stepmother, who loved him dearly, Lana, had just gotten Stone's belongings from the place where he lived, and they had been talking about their grief and their anger, and they were lying in their bed having this conversation about Stone and how just pissed off they were. And Lana said, they were talking about the place where they thought that Stone got the drug that killed him. And Lana said, I hope he haunts that place. And they moved on with their conversation. Well, a little bit later, Lana asked Dave if he had checked the notes in Stone's cell phone, you know, in your iPhone, or it's probably in all phones, but I only have an iPhone, so I make myself grocery lists. I note books that I want to read, and So if anything ever happens to me, look in my notes on my phone. But Lana asked Dave if he had looked in the notes, and he said, no, I've been meaning to do that. I think I will. And so he got Stone's cell phone, which they had just recently gotten back, and he opened up the notes. And the first note that he opened said, now this is Stone's phone, it said, I will haunt this bar. So the exact words that Lana had said were right there in his notes. That's a clue. Stone was right there. Now, about that time, in the next room, there was a big bang. Was it Stone? I think so. Probably. Dave and Lana think so. He's right here with us. And the same is true for all. For Paul, for Lindsay, for Stone, for Bertram, for Speck. Don't you know those two dogs had so much love in their lives? Where could they have gone? Where could they have gone? They're with each other. I see Speck right down there. Remember how David would throw the ball to Speck and she would catch it? Only when he threw the ball, she would never catch it when it was like on camera or in front of the audience. She would only do it when we weren't looking. Well, she's right here. That ball is bouncing around and she's coming around and getting her love from everybody. Had an experience of death with my daughter, Allie. You really have to be open to know that the people who have died are communicating with us. You have to be open. And sometimes the older we get, the more closed we become to that idea. Well, my children had a babysitter. She really was a member of the family. She was a babysitter in that she kept the kids every day while I worked, but she was beloved. They called her Grandma June. And they stayed with her from when Richard, who is now 34 years old, they stayed with her from the time he was 6 weeks old until she passed away. Allie, who's 3 years younger, started going to Grandma June's house when she was 2 weeks old. I didn't have maternity leave and I had to work, so I went back to work and Allie went to Grandma June's. So they were at Mountain Gap School just over here, and Richard was in middle school and Allie was in elementary school when one day Grandma June just didn't wake up. She had a cold and the doctors think she probably had some kind of blood clot or stroke or whatever physical thing it is that stops the body. But I got a call from Grandma June's daughter, and she told me that Grandma June had passed away, and she wanted me to let the kids know. And so I went to pick Allie up from school, and I was all prepared to tell the story of Grandma June's death. And Allie got in the car, and I said, honey, I've got something really bad to tell you. And she said, oh, I know, Grandma June died. And I said, what? How do you know that? Yes, she did. She passed away, but how do you know that? And she said, well, I was sitting at my desk and Grandma June came to me and told me that she died, but it's okay. I'm not to worry. I said, when did this happen? She said, well, I was in school today. So it wasn't even a dream at night. It was during class. Allie was just sitting there at her desk and she had Grandma June come to her and say, I've died, but I'm okay. You're not to worry about me. And truly, of all the people that I know, Allie has one of the most profound appreciation of death. Grandma June taught her in that moment that it's okay. I'm okay. you're not to worry. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could have that experience with everyone that made their transition and left our life? I did have that experience with Lindsay. I had a dream. It was a nighttime dream. And she came to me. We were at a party, and we went into a room on the side, and she was covered in road rash. She had all these cuts and scrapes and bruises, and I was trying desperately to fix her. You know, I was trying to clean her wounds and bandage her wounds and put Humpty Dumpty back together again, so to speak. And she just kept brushing me off and saying, "Stop that. I'm okay. Stop that. I'm fine. I'm okay. I'm okay." And when I woke up from that dream, I thought, wow, that was weird. How can this be? But in discussions later with David, he said, "That was Lindsay coming to you and telling you it's okay." I really didn't recognize it at the time. But that's what it was. John O'Donohue talks about the soulmate in death, and he says that dreams are really our thinnest veil between the spirit world and the physical world. And so often, our soulmates who have passed or who have transitioned or died, they'll come to us in our dreams. I know Dave and Lana pray for Stone to come to them in their dreams. He did come to his brother, Gage, already, and it was the same dream. They were in a car, and I think they were going to Sonic or somewhere to get a drink. I may be telling this story wrong, and I'm sorry if I am, Anderson family. But all of a sudden, Stone looked at Gage and just said, "Hey, I gotta go." And he left. But he was fine. He was okay. I think when people die, and dogs, and cats, and really all sentient beings, we who are left behind tend to awfulize it. You know, isn't it sad? I mean, our initial reaction definitely often awfulizes it. But even later, you know, we look at a life and we think, or we say, it ended too soon. Or it ended in tragedy, as with an accident, an overdose, a car wreck. It ended with suffering. I know that a lot of us thought that Bertram was suffering. But you know, in Buddhism, it's not our place to take on the suffering of others. It's not our place to end the suffering of others. It's not our place to judge the suffering of others. And I will tell you this, on Wednesday morning, Bertram and I went for a walk in the alley. He was wagging his tail. He was making little hoppy, skippy jumps. He was so happy to see Chris. Is Chris here? Chris had an air conditioner truck outside his house this morning. He might be suffering in heat. Bertram went up to Chris and said hello. He went down the alley. He pooped. He peed. He went around the garden. He spoke to Napoleon, the fish. He sniffed every leaf there was to sniff. He went around to the front. He had a long drink of water. And then we went inside. Now, I had to carry him up the stairs because he could not go up and down stairs anymore. But as soon as we got up the stairs, he walked in the house. He waited for his treat. He went and he laid down on his bed. He took a big, heavy sigh, and he laid down and he took the first nap of the day. Throughout the day on Wednesday, this is how he was. He was happy. He was fine. And then Wednesday night, it was rainy, it was slick, it was dark outside. And we went out into the most magnificently beautiful garden. If you've ever been to David and Trey's house, you know what I'm talking about. It's just spectacular. And Bert wandered around the back side of the house, and there's a, I think it's an old hydrangea that has draped one of her limbs across the path, and Bert could go right under that limb with no effort. He just walked right past it. Well, I had to struggle and bend over and move it, and so he got a little bit ahead of me. And I mean, if that's not a metaphor for life and death, I don't know what is. Bert had no trouble. He went through it with ease. I struggled. Well, when I finally got to Bert, he had laid down in the beautiful wet greenery. And when I went to lift him up, he could no longer get his feet under his body in a balanced manner. So we struggled for a few minutes. I struggled to get Bert back into the house to what I thought of as safety. And during that struggle, he just kept looking at me with those old Bert eyes. I probably can't do his talk as well as David, but Bert just said, "Oh, come on, let's go back in the house. Come on, let's go. You can carry me. It's fine. I'm fine." We got back inside, and I just realized that his breath was becoming harder for him. And throughout that night, Wednesday night, I kept waking up. I don't think I really slept all night. I kept getting up and going to Bert, and I'd lay down beside him, and he was still there. He was still, you know, breathing, and he started doing this moaning, groaning thing where it was just like he was telling me, This doesn't feel good anymore. I don't feel good. So Thursday morning, I spoke with David and Trey, and we all agreed that we should call the vet. And Bert and I loaded up and went and saw Dr. Renfro, who is an angel. And Dr. Renfro put his hand on his face, and he said, "It's time to go." He said, "It's just time." So I held Bert's hand and I put my hand on his face, and Dr. Renfro and his wonderful assistant stayed there with us. And there's this wonderful magic juice that they use. And I think it's such a blessing that we can help our animals when it gets to this time, when it gets to this point. I think it's just one of the greatest gifts that we can give them to help them. Not to ease their suffering, not to end their pain, but to help them, to assist them in their rebirthing process, to assist them on their way out. And y'all, I swear that doctor did not even have to use the medication. Bert knew it was over, and he just breathed his last breath, and there was this huge release. Just let go. And he didn't linger. He didn't hang around and say, you know, to my heart or to my brain, "You did the right thing," or "You didn't do the right thing," or nothing. He just left. He was gone. So we went home. I went home and I talked to Humphrey and Napoleon and the house, and I told them all what had happened. And I know Bertram is there. I know he's in that little fairy house. He's waiting on David and Trey to come home. If you've ever seen their house from the road, it looks just like a little elf cabin. It's a little storybook home there in the garden with the leaves hanging over it and the prayer flags and the peace flags everywhere. It's just the perfect, perfect place. So when we lose to death, whoever it is, Vandana, Paul, Glory G's beautiful grandson who left us, our mothers, our children, our dog, our cat, our beloved horse whoever it is, they're not gone. Their body is gone. It's beyond our physical ability to see them. But their soul, their spirit was never born, and it never dies, and it stays eternally. It's forever. Now, our feeling of that might come in waves. It might come and go. But it is eternal as anything. I can't even think of a good analogy. I was going to say it's as eternal as time. But we all know that time and space aren't real, especially to the soul. There's no concept of an hour or a millennium for the soul. It's just here, now, fully present. Our memory of our loved ones is purely the soul's expression coming to us after their death. Our dreams, our photographs, Bert's collar laying on the table, waiting for David and Trey. His soul is there. It's not the material collar that will bring Bert back. It's the memory of his soul. It's being open to hearing the jingle of his collar. It's been years since he went up and down the stairs, but you know, there his paw patter, the sound of his collar, the jingle, the footprints, they're there. They'll be there. They'll be there for David and Trey when they get back from Maine, from their holiday. So I was thinking of so many poems, and the older I get and the more funerals I've been to, the more cliche some of these sayings and poems. And you know, there's the one that's, "Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there, I do not sleep." There's the analogy of the ship unfurling her sails, sailing over the horizon. On this side, we see her sailing and we say, "Goodbye. Goodbye, goodbye, we'll miss you." And then as she sails over the horizon, there are people, there are souls on the other side saying, "There she is, look, she's coming, finally she's here." It's just which side of the horizon we're on. How many of you have heard of Strongheart? Who knows Strongheart? Who knows Ren 10-10? How many more of you know Ren 10-10? Well, Strongheart was the actor that played Ren 10-10. He died in 1939. And his beloved friend, J. Allen Boone, wrote, for the rest of his life, J. Allen Boone, he wrote letters to Strongheart everywhere he went in the world. He would write to Strongheart and he would talk to him and tell him stories. And it's one of the most beautiful books I've ever read. David gave me this book right after I started coming here and talking about death. This is Ren 10-10. It's a beautiful, beautiful German Shepherd. He was so intelligent that he spoke multiple human languages, as well as canine, and as well as the language of love. And I can think of no better eulogy for any soul than the first letter to Strongheart from J. Allen Boone. It's pretty short, so I'm going to read it to you. It's called Sunbeams. Imagine the sunbeam coming through the window and laying on the rug by the window. Close your eyes and think of the warmth and the feeling of safety and protection that sunbeam gives to you and those who find its beautiful space. To Strong Heart, it's addressed in the eternal playground out yonder. Dear old pal, ever since they told me that you had suddenly changed your world, as the Japanese so quaintly express it, I have wanted to write to you and tell you some things that are in my mind and heart about us, things too intimate and deep to discuss with human beings. I do not have to tell you that I am mentally standing by. You know that. Our friendship is geared for eternity, so whatever the seeming, nothing can get in between us and separate us. Nothing. I miss you very much, of course. And so does everyone else. So does our little house, your toys and games, even the Hollywood Hills, they miss you. The black cat across the street, which seemed to take such delight in climbing over the fence and making you chase it, she misses you. But I know that all is well with you now and always. It has to be, for you are in and a part of the great eternal plan. Thin-souled people with sluggish imaginations and dimmed inner fires are saying that you are dead, buried and gone. Strong Heart is dead, they are assuring each other. Deader than a doornail. It's a pity, too, with all that popularity and money he was earning. Well, he may have been famous, but that didn't save him from having to die like the rest of us. When his time came, he was just an ordinary dog, and that's the end of the famous Strong Heart. Chatter, chatter, chatter. I hear it everywhere. The newspapers, the radios, they are proclaiming your death. They are saying it empathetically and with finality, like Supreme Court judges handing down irrevocable decisions. I wish I could point a finger at them the size of a lighthouse and shout, "Now listen, my funeral friends, I happen to be a very personal friend of Strong Heart's. And as his personal friend, I should like to ask all of you, just what do you think he was made of? So many pounds of hide and bones and stuffing, a material body with something animating it on the inside, which has now stopped functioning? Well, if you do, you are mistaken, very much so. You may have been looking at something like that, or at least you thought you were with those material eyes of yours. But what you were actually seeing were his qualities. That's what this dog was made of, qualities. That's what Bert was made of. Let me name a few of them for you. Goodness. Loyalty. Understanding. Enthusiasm. Fidelity. Devotion. Sincerity. Nobility. Honesty. Affection. Confidence. Strength. Gentleness, happiness, gratitude, appreciation. Humility, purity, unselfishness, fearlessness, love. And all of the hundreds of synonyms that parade in back of those terms. Qualities, my friends. Grade one qualities. Even among the human species, those are the things he was made of, not some shadowy, unsubstantial phantom stuff called matter, but qualities, qualities of the highest excellence. And write this down on the tablets of your memories with the point of a diamond. Those qualities of Strong Heart's can no more die and be buried in a hole than a collection of sunbeams. They are eternal. And Strong Heart is just as eternal as his qualities. Let me say it once more. Strong Heart is just as eternal as his qualities. At this moment, you seem beyond my human vision and range of my whistle, but I do not know how to throw the old tennis ball for you as much as I would like to. But that's my fault. All of us humans are more or less affected by this low and limited quality, this limited visibility. It has a tendency to give us a distorted and contradictory notion about what actually is and what actually is not happening to the people and things about us. We squint at life instead of looking at it clear-eyed and steadily. We bend our thinking process inward and downward instead of upward and outward. And that, according to the diagnosticians among us, is why the human is in almost continuous state of confusion, and why existence for him seems to be such an irrational and unexplained whirligig of birth and death, coming and going, success and failure, happiness and unhappiness, good and evil, and all the other contradictions, this is key, peculiar to materiality. When the human side is able to identify other forms of life within his immediate seeing range, he pronounces them alive and in existence. But when they do not happen within his narrow focus, he regards them as dead or out of existence and acts accordingly. That is what the world of human beings is doing to you. They cannot identify you with their material senses. So as far as they're concerned, you're gone through forever and ever. Had you been a human, they probably would have conceded that you had had enough of this life, this so-and-so, this something or other, that would get you to this earthly or beyond this earthly existence. But only being a dog, you'll remain ordinary and stationary. But there's a joker in the situation. This is the best part, y'all. I refuse to concur in the general verdict on you. I refuse to agree that you are either dead through or out of existence forever and ever. I am voting no to the human world's yes. It is a very tiny vote, considering the opposition's pile, but it is enough to keep that death verdict from you and from it becoming unanimous. Let others believe what they want to. That is their privilege, but I want no part of that, for as far as I am concerned, you are just as vitally alive and just as much the old pal now as ever. It could not be otherwise. I know too much about the expanse of the real you. I'll be seeing you. I'll be seeing you, Lindsay, and Stone, Bert, and Speck, and Paul, and everyone else that we called together this morning. We'll be seeing you on that eternal playground. Not somewhere, not someday, but right now, in this experience, in this moment. They're here with us. And so it is.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. For more information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org.